That no longer disqualifies you. Old age is like a pre-qualification being elected. Okay,
yes,
I mean, you know, in some of the biggest democracies in the world, the older the better.
No, this is true.
Mark, hi, good morning.
Good morning. Although the weather is creeping up on us, and winter, might I say, at last seems to be arriving. We haven't had like a winter, and it's nearly solstice time. Okay. But that aside, I'm feeling a curious excitement about where we are post-elections. Is that...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm feeling that, you know, sort of democracy is at work, and I'm feeling that lessons and truths have emerged beyond the what I might describe as the sycophantic bullshitting of everyday politics. So I'm kind of like, I'm intrigued by the numbers, and I'd have a few things to say about the lessons we might have learned on the way. And your thoughts, your first thoughts.
I'm absolutely sitting on the knife edge, because in some ways, I think it's fantastic. If you are a believer that a party that rules badly and doesn't stamp out corruption with meaning, that party should get fewer votes, I'm happy about that. You know what I mean? That's a plus for me.
Yeah.
I'm just a little curious as to what our future might be.
Okay, well, let's
whether or not we are in the Venezuelan frame, for example.
Yeah. Well, I think there is that. I think there's a split in the road here. We either get to the sensible government of national unity kind of discussion, or we get to the separatist gathering of the againsts. Okay.
And so there is.
So we can talk about some of our views on that, but I there are some lessons for me that with the benefit of hindsight, of course,
right,
come to the fore. And the first one is that democracy does speak. You know, I think we were all surprised at some of the results, MK in particular, and various others, and the statistics. And there's been a lot of talk about how science could have predicted this. I'm not convinced, but there it is. Now, what didn't work, which is what interested me, sucker politics didn't work. Let me, what do I call those? You know, sort of, you know, we'll sign into law the NHI thing, and we will, you know, we will now just have signed the two-pot retirement thing. Of course, I want to talk about that again. We signed into law or outlaw dacha. We can now, you know, smoke and cultivate dacha to our hearts or minds, should I say, content. But, I think that we don't give the population enough credit for them to discern between the bullshit they've been fed and the truth that they see. And they've seen the truth, and they've voted for reality, not misleading, misguided. I don't know. That's my sense of it.
Well, can't you argue this both ways, though? This is the problem with politics. It's not clear. So what I thought was encouraging, and what I think is a lesson learned out of this election, is that the ANC believes that handing out more cookies to its supporters from the public wheel is a vote catcher. So just before the election, they did two things, which they announced that they supported NHI and they signed the two-pot system into action, both of which are arguably fiscal responsibility bad, service good, right? There is some evidence that the decision to go ahead with NHI, far from helping the ANC, hurt it. You know, we don't have precise numbers on this, but you have to say that the general, you know, apart from MK, the estimates by the pollsters prior to the election were very good.
Yeah.
They sort of hit the mark pretty well. So if they are doing that pretty well, then, you know, I'm inclined to trust them when they say that the ANC was sitting at 45% before it decided to endorse NHI. And as soon as it did, it dropped down to 40. So that's your voters being sensible, right? But the voters not being sensible, I mean, how do you explain? I mean, there are ways to explain it, but it is a question why MK got so much support. Not that it got support, that I think that was pretty inevitable, but that it got, you know, twice as much as the pollsters were talking about. What's your explanation there?
I think it's a protest. I think it's just the manifestation of a protest against, you know, erstwhile colleagues and sort of a localized center of strength, which was able to gather people together who are discontent. Not only, you know, not only a protest vote against, you know, the guys that kicked you out, but a general discontent with what's being delivered in KZN, for example. And so I think people just said, we've had enough. You know, now I'd be surprised, you know, at the longevity of this initiative, because, you know, I think the question is, what happens with that 14.6%? What is it used for? What does it become? What does it end up being? And so, you know, I'm not sure it's going to be an enduring thing, but it was certainly, I think, I don't know anyone who wasn't surprised by it. Maybe there were those that saw it coming, but if they did, they would have, I think, acted differently. Now, you know, they do potentially center the alternative to a government of national unity, if I might say so, or another form of a government of national unity, which is not based on the country, but based on political alliance. And I think that could be a dangerous alternative outcome to focusing on the country now, because the politics is over.
I think I agree with you. You know, you can't tell in politics, right? Stuff happens. But as it stands at the moment, you know, protest votes have a way of unraveling. Because if you protest against this now, you know, you could protest against something else later, especially in the context of a party which has one enormous advantage, and that is the name recognition of its leader, who is 82. So
that no longer disqualifies you. Old age is like a pre-qualification for being elected. Okay.
Yes,
in some of the biggest democracies in the world, the older the better.
No, this is true. But in any case, you'd have to say, unless the MK party plays its cards pretty well from here on in, it could also turn into a disappointment for its supporters. That's true of any party, you know. I don't know whether you've read the manifesto of the MK party. I mean, it's frightening. It is frightening. I mean, they want to rip up the constitution. You know, it is the explicit policy of the organization that they want to scrap the constitution. And they want to reduce the number of provinces to four, you know, and they want to go back on democracy. You know, they want a house of traditional leaders which has decision-making power. You know,
all of these, you know, somewhat magical, fantastical thought processes are only possible in a field of disappointment. Okay, and so I would argue that a good proportion of that, it's just electioneering, you know. It's just like promise something as different as you possibly can to the status quo, and people will have a go. Okay. Now, that's one form of protest vote. There's another less acceptable, in my view, form of protest vote, and that's not to vote at all. Now, if my numbers are correct, there were like 16.2 million people voting, which is whatever it is, you know, less than a third of the population. And so you would only need 8.1 million people, only 8.1 million people, which is less than 15% of the total, you know, eligible population, to vote for you to control the country. Okay. That's not a lot of people. And then the final sort of nail in the coffin of the protest vote was the fact that the majority, I'll say that again, the majority of eligible voters didn't vote. That is, not just those who were registered but didn't vote, but those who were eligible and didn't register. That is the failing of protest.
Yep.
Don't you think?
No, it's true. It's extraordinary. It's the absolute number of people who voted declined in this election. Obviously, consequently, the proportion declined. If you sort of calculated out a minority of eligible voters actually cast their votes, it is extraordinary. And but you know, that's also a protest, right? That's also part of a protest vote. But that is a protest vote happening right there.
Yeah, but it's an impotent process, in my view. It is. I mean, I was standing in the queue actually with my son, who was a first time voter, and he was quite frankly excited about that. And he felt sort of, you know, he'd become a valid citizen and all these kind of things because he recently turned 18. And so we're standing in this queue, and the form, the spirit, the camaraderie was all good. And you're all talking about the queue, and we got on to talking about people who didn't vote. And my response to that was, if you didn't vote, shut up. Okay.
Mm.
You lose your right to speak. And so...
But maybe that's true, but maybe it's also that the political system, it's not only your fault, it's the fault of the political system. The political system is not finding you. It's not finding your voice. It's not finding your aspirations.
Well, then make your own party and get on with it. Yeah.
Well, lots of people tried. And that's another aspect of this election is a lot of people, a lot of the new innovations really didn't do very well, which...
Yeah, I think they're laying the groundwork for 2029.
I would, this is true.
I would support that hypothesis. Yeah.
All right. Can I quote you a very old quote?
Yes.
Which has been quoted in 1,000,000,000 different contexts, but it's just really very, very true now. And it was written by...
anything but a very young quote. Go for it, Tim. 100,000,000 in one time. Yeah. What? I can't wait, Brad. People are listening now. They can't wait. They've stopped what they're doing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Antonio Gramsci, the crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. He says in prison notebooks in 1931. I mean, it is true, the comparative election in around the world to this one in South Africa, I would say is the Indian election. Not the one that's taking place now, but the one that's taking place now is after the realignment has taken place.
Yeah.
The one that we're talking about is the election that took place exactly 30 years after 1927.
Oh,
which was when the Congress Party, the Congress of Mahatma Gandhi, lost the majority vote, or lost its majority in parliament. And maybe there's a law that liberation movements fade after 30 years. I mean, it'd be interesting, hypothesis.
That coincides with the kind of definition, loose definition of what constitutes a generation. Okay,
yeah,
so now,
exactly.
So I don't think, whatever lessons and whatever results and whatever gatherings and absent arise out of this election, the big lesson, the big move is still going to happen. And that move for me is the delegation of executive authority from the politicians to the DGs that start in this state. I mean, in business, in commercial business, we are very clear that there are shareholders, the board, and the executive. Let's make the CEO a proxy for them. And there's a clear process of appointing the board, overseeing the CEO, getting a mandate and getting on with the job. And the CEO can survive any number of changes in shareholdings and board members if the CEO is growing the company and doing well. So who are our CEOs? Well, in the state, the CEOs are the DGs. And what I like about them is that they don't have to follow some popularity contest to get appointed, although they have up to now, okay?
Yeah.
So you don't need, you know, to be on a list somewhere or to pass a parliamentary process. If you're the best person for the job, you can be appointed to do that job. That's what I think is going to be the decider. You know, not who's in charge, but who they put in charge.
Yes. Now, that's right. I mean, I always thought the best analogy was that if you are the board in this situation, in other words, the minister and the sort of government in general, what you do is you choose a captain, and then the captain goes out and sails the ship. And if the captain sails the ship badly, what you do is you go in and you choose another captain. That is your job. But the actual sailing of the ship is really up to the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
And the utility of that process is that the captain of the ship's performance is measurable and obvious.
Yeah, and not only measurable, but it requires a license, okay? You can't willy-nilly walk onto a ship and start sailing it or fly an aeroplane or drive a car, for that matter, without a license.
Yes.
And yet you can run an extraordinary department, the future of which will influence the future, you know, validity and survival of our country without a license. And that license is knowledge, competence, education, all of the elements and leadership and so on. And so until we cross that bridge, Tim, it doesn't matter who's in charge. It doesn't matter who the shareholder is. It doesn't matter who we vote for. It matters whether they have the foresight and the ability to welcome into their house those who can get the job done for a just 3-year period, and so that this transition that we all dreamed and hoped for can manifest through the right, you know, founding principles. We need to start planting our future and stop eating our past. Okay.
Yes.
That'll be quoted in 2480. Okay. Yes.
I mean, it's very difficult. With the best will in the world, I say to people, we must stop living in the past. We must concentrate on our futures. And I say that because it's important. I think it's important for young people to start looking at their lives in a different way. And yet every political party in South Africa seems to be consumed by its past.
Well, we are.
And there is a logic in that. You know, there is a sort of positive logic, but it's understandable. You know what was interesting to me was I was reading yesterday the MK Manifesto, which is kind of bizarre in a lot of ways, because there's a lot of things in it that are very unexpected. One of which is, by the way, they're very keen on getting investment, you know, which surprised me for a party that sort of pegs itself as an anti-global consensus left-wing party.
No one can breathe without oxygen, Tim.
No, I know. But you know, the interesting thing was that the whole manifesto starts off with the striving towards dignity. I think the first chapter is called Regaining Our Dignity or something along those lines. And that seems to me a very big thrust. And if you look through all of the measures, it's about cultural dignity, personal dignity, and how that has been, you know, undermined, first of all, by imperialism, then by racism. And for us as, you know, well-to-do white South Africans, it's easy for us to say, let's focus on the future. It would be different if we were different people.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, I totally subscribe to the notion of dignity. You know, and I've repeatedly said over the last 8 or longer years that I've been somehow linked or involved in government, that our objective is to deliver at least the prospect of economic dignity so that we become united in that cause. But along with dignity, in our multi everything society, there must be tolerance. Okay, because otherwise you need a dignity, a culture to prevail, so strongly to prevail that it can't possibly coexist with others. So we have this unique problem that we're looking for solutions that are generally applicable into a very, very diverse, by any measure, population. It's an almost unsolvable puzzle without extraordinary leadership and extraordinary economic growth to fund the balancing equation of our future. And so that's our conundrum.
Yeah. You know? I mean, this is the biggest problem with this election is that this is a growth negative election because it just becomes, government just becomes very unstable. Whichever direction the ANC goes, whether if the ANC goes into alliance with the EFF or it goes into alliance with the DA, in both scenarios, we are a more fractious society. Now, it's possible we have to go through that, you know, that this is part of the renewal process. Anyway, we don't have a choice. The electors have decided that. That's our future.
Yeah.
Well, we can't whine about it. We've got to make this work.
Yeah.
What is your guess about which way the ANC would go? Do you have one? What is their preference and what is their inclination?
Let me say this. I think the ANC were very gracious in defeat so far, you know, in the way that they accepted the outcome and talked about common interests and things of that nature. And I would be surprised and
too
upset.
Gracious in my
possibly anyway, as you said, but I would be surprised and upset if the alliances were to fall into the groups that seek to divide rather than unite. Okay, and that temptation and that consequence are too ghastly to contemplate. Okay, and so if we start going back to racial divide as a decider, if we start going back to the things that started the trouble in the first place, you know, another form of apartheid, then we've gone nowhere and we deserve our demise, which will surely come upon us. Okay, and our isolation, which will surely be repeated. And so I hope that we see enough of a future, and it goes to your point earlier about the youth. I hope that our future, the youth, see a future long enough to vote for and stay in and become involved in. So far, not so good. But we need people who've got a longer future than a past to be in charge. And I think they'll go. I think sense will prevail because it won't be good if it doesn't.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Amen to all of that. You know, there's this sort of idea going around that what the DA should offer the ANC is an extremely lightweight, not alliance, but a lightweight agreement to let the ANC rule as a minority party so long as it doesn't do a deal with the EFF. Yeah. But, you know, I think that the ANC people themselves, ANC leadership themselves, you know, I think they kind of like the EFF. I think they used to be comrades. They're part of the same party. Like the militancy. Yeah. They think that maybe if they get the EFF into the ANC, they could sort of win them over. I hate to say this, but I think the odds are, unlike, you know, what my colleagues have been arguing for ages, the odds are that they go into an alliance with the EFF.
The risk of the bigger merger between more equal forces is mutual cannibalization. Okay, so that one of the parties gets absorbed into the other and the cultures get dropped and all that sort of thing. So we've got 2 weeks to decide and then 30 days not to decide or something of that nature. Let's wait and see. I've given up second guessing the numbers. I'm hoping for a change in approach. Now, we have to end off with a number, talking about numbers.
Okay.
My number of the week, Tim.
Yeah, go.
Is that Elon Musk, as I understand it, is proposing what someone described politely as an excessively sized payday. And guess how much he wants to be paid out of...
Excessive, you know, it's like a million rand.
Yeah, well, that's not really what he had in mind. He was thinking more along the lines of $56 billion. Okay.
Okay.
Now, Tim, you've got to eat, man.
You know, you've got to eat.
You've got to get by. Okay.
Yeah, you've got to have taxi fare. You know, I mean, there's stuff that you just have to have. So, you know, I understand that.
And there was a more interesting down-to-earth story of a couple in New York who found a safe in a lake which had $100,000 in it. Now, I don't know what the law says, but when I went to school, it was finders keepers, okay? Losers weepers, okay? So I'd keep it, and I don't know why they told anybody.
Anyway,
exciting times, dude.
All right, Mark.
Let's see what we have to say next week when we know more of this stuff.
Cool, man. Look after yourself.
Cheers.